In the last month, my family passed another milestone. I began to teach my second teenager how to drive a car. So if you ever happen to be on church grounds during the week and you see a tan Chevy Malibu kind of doing the loop again and again and again, never fear, it's just Trace and me getting our driving hours in. As we've gotten into this teaching period, one of the things that I've said to him is, you have to think really hard about a lot of this stuff now, and remembering to do this, and remembering to do that, and look here, and you really have to focus on remembering those things, but there will come a time when those things will be kind of second nature. They'll be instinctive. You won't even have to think about them. You'll just do them. Along those lines, what I am now having to do as the driving instructor is I have to take these things that I am used to doing without thinking, and I have to think about how do I actually do them. So, when you're turning the wheel, where do your hands go? And, how do you, when you're backing up, how do you do that? And how do you pull into a parking space straight? And how do I parallel park? I don't do that a whole lot. All of those things, you have to, as you're training, you have to move them from being unconscious, automatic things that you just do to things that you can explain to someone else. Now, I have a question that is going to sound unrelated, but I'll tie it together in just a moment. The question is this: why does it seem that Christians fail to have an influence, or at least a positive influence, on society, on culture, on people around us? Why do we fail to have the kind of influence that Jesus would say that we should have, that we want to have? Why do we fail to have that kind of influence? If you're part of a growth group, that would be a great question for you to discuss today. But let me, jump past that, and let me suggest an answer to you. And this comes from Pastor Steve Deneff. He frames the question this way: how can we have so many Christians in our city without changing the culture? Here's his answer. The problem is not that these Christians are faking it, or that they are too silent about their witness, but that they are following Jesus and are still not oriented like him. The problem is that they are following Jesus, and yet they are still not oriented like him. Now, let me try and explain what he means there. And to do that, I want to take you to a particular story in the scriptures. And I'm not going to read it for you, but you can turn there. Mark chapter 8, and then you can see this particular story. In Mark 8, this chapter is kind of the hinge point of the whole book of Mark. Everything is kind of working its way up to what happens in this story, and then everything that follows flows from what happens in this story. So Jesus is traveling with his disciples, and he asks them the question, "Who do people say that I am?" And so the disciples, they give some different answers. This prophet or that prophet from long ago that has been raised from the dead and has now come back. And then he follows up and he says, "Okay, so who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter, the rock among the disciples, speaks up and says, "You are the Messiah." And I imagine that if you're Jesus in that moment, you're thinking, they're finally getting it. It's finally dawning on them what is going on here and what I'm all about. So then Jesus goes on from there and he starts to talk about how he is going to have to suffer and how he will ultimately die. And Jesus doesn't take that too well. He says, in fact, when Peter counters him and says, that it will never be such, Jesus says to him, "Get behind me, Satan." He's speaking to Peter. Now, he's not calling Peter the devil, but he's, talking about the word Satan in a general sense means opponent or adversary. He's saying to Peter, who has just rebuked him for talking about suffering and dying, he says, "Get behind me, opponent. Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. Now, you could read that and you could think, oh, well, Jesus is just saying, you know, when he says you don't have in mind the concerns of God, oh, well, you're thinking about something else. But Jesus is saying something more than that. He's saying your whole way of thinking, your whole way of being and acting in the world, your orientation, your wiring are completely different than the way God is wired, than his orientation, than his values and his priorities. Your whole way of thinking needs to shift. Steve Deneff, who I quoted a moment ago, he goes on and he says this. Discipleship, that is, you know, being Jesus' disciple, following him, discipleship has as its goal nothing less than the rewiring of our instincts and the reprogramming of our nature. The goal of discipleship is not only to get us to act like Jesus, but also to react like Jesus. It is to absorb the mind of Jesus into ours until we think and act like him without even trying. Back to my driving example. You know, after 30 almost years of driving, there's a whole lot that I do just by instinct without even thinking, and many of you would be the same. And in many areas of our lives, there are things that we do just by instinct. Well, Deneff says that the goal of discipleship is not just to get us consciously acting like Jesus, but to have the mind and character of Jesus, to be wired like Jesus, to have the kind of orientation that Jesus has toward life, so much so that even the things that we don't even think about doing, the involuntary things, the unconscious things, are like Jesus. So we're beginning a series today called Make the Shift. And the key question is, what are the, if we were going to, change in such a way that even the things that we do without thinking were like Jesus, what kind of shifts would it take to make that possible? And so over the coming weeks, we'll talk about 7 different shifts that can happen in our lives that will help us not only to be hopefully consciously thinking and acting like Jesus, but even unconsciously, even without thinking, to be more and more like Jesus. And there is certainly, as we talk about these shifts, there is a part for God to do. So this series is based on a book called Soul Shift. And if you'd like a copy of it, there are copies available by donation in the hub. But the whole idea of a soul shift is the idea that something inside you has to change, and it's probably not something that you can just make happen yourself. God has to do something inside you. But then, if that's going to happen, then there is something for us to do. There is something for you and me to do, some things that we can do that will allow God to do his work. We have to recognize the need for a shift inside ourselves. We have to be open to the shift. We can even take on certain practices that will help us to experience those shifts. We can be part of growth groups. And it's not too late. If you haven't joined a group, we have various groups that are meeting over the next 7 weeks to go deeper with these shifts. And so if you go in our church app and go to My Groups, you can join a group. Or again, at the Hub, there are guides that will tell you what groups are available. We want to think together about these shifts that God can make in us as we open ourselves up to it and allow him to do it. The first shift is the shift from me to you. From me to you. And great illustration of this shift comes in Mark chapter 9. So if you open your Bible to Mark 8, you maybe want to jump to Mark chapter 9. And we're going to jump kind of into the middle of a little episode here that Jesus has, again, with his disciples. In verse 33, it says, they came to Capernaum, that is Jesus and his disciples. When he was in a house, he asked them, what were you arguing about on the road? You know, they probably thought that this was just a little private conversation amongst themselves, but Jesus has a way of picking up on those things, doesn't he? So what were you arguing about on the road, Jesus asks. But they kept quiet because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all. When we talk about a soul shift, we're talking about making the shift. We're talking about moving from something to something else, from one orientation, from one way of being to another. In this case today, we're talking about going from me to you, and we can see that in the disciples here. Jesus is saying, you know, you're focused on me. You want to be each of you wants to be the greatest for yourself. I'm calling you to a shift where instead of wanting greatness for yourself, you want to serve each other. You want to serve others. But of course, there's a problem with that. Problem that the disciples had, a problem that we have today. One church leader from generations ago described the problem this way. The problem is that each one of us has a heart that is curved inward upon itself. Deneff says that he calls it a genetic flaw towards self-centeredness. The Bible's word for it, you know, just to keep it simple, is the word sin. Now, sin is a word that, you know, you probably don't hear much outside of church. And if you ever wonder what is sin, what is at the heart of sin, you know, just look at the middle letter. It's I. Sin is when I have to be at the center of everything. It's when I see the universe revolving around me. And other people need to fit into my plan. And so when we talk about what we need to make a shift from, you know, the simplest way to say it, I think, is we need to make a shift from me, myself, and I at the center of everything. We have to shift from that. How does this focus on me, this focus on self, this self-centeredness, this I at the center of the universe, how does that manifest itself? Well, in all kinds of ways. I mean, we naturally look out for ourselves first. Case in point, now if you're looking at a group photo, who do you tend to look at first in the group photo? Or, you know, more to the times in which we live, if you're in a Zoom meeting, you know, whose box do you tend to focus on the most? Maybe I should just speak for myself here. You know, I find myself sometimes focusing a little too much on my little box and, you know, boy, the lighting really looks bad. I look really washed out here. And, you know, why is my hair doing that thing? And, you know, I need to angle the camera a little better so I don't have a double chin. You know, any of you do all these kinds of things? You focus on that one little box. Looking out for myself first. Think of a young child sitting on the floor, holding on to a bunch of toys while there are other kids around. You've seen that picture before? You know, of course, the kid can't possibly play with all those toys at one time, but they're my toys. So, you know, they can't play with them, they're mine. What else? You know, we tend to talk about ourselves a lot. Sometimes we have trouble listening to other people. We cut in line, whether it's the lunch line or, you know, the merge lane in traffic. We're critical of each other because, you know, my ideas obviously are better. You know, we can be competitive because, you know, it's no fun if I can't win and I have to show that I'm better than you. We hold grudges because how dare you hurt me like that? Even low self-esteem. You know, you think of if someone having low self-esteem is being focused on other people, but really low self-esteem is just another form of being focused on yourself and your own standards and how you're failing to meet those standards compared to others. Even, this is so interesting, even some people's desire for meaningful relationships with others can ultimately be self-centered. Dietrich Bonhoeffer says this about Christians. He says, those who love their dream of a Christian community more than the Christian community itself become destroyers of that Christian community, even though their personal intentions may be ever so honest, earnest, and sacrificial. This is because they demand that their dream be fulfilled by God and others and themselves. Even our desire to be in relationship with others ultimately can be about us. And so we need to make a shift. We need to make a shift from being focused on me, on ourselves, to being focused on others. And I want to take you back to the text that Daylene read for us this morning, to 1 John chapter 4. And again, I'd encourage you to turn there if you can, and I'm not going to read it again, but I want to walk us through this text and what it has to say about the shift from me to you. 1 John 4, we come to verse 10. And as we look at that verse, the one thing that we see is kind of a definition of love. Love is so interesting to define. When I meet with couples to do premarital counseling, one of the questions that I ask them is, how do you define love? And you know, as you could imagine, answers go all over the place because there's so many different ways of thinking about and describing love. Well, here in 1 John 4, John says the ultimate reality of love is God's love shown to us in Jesus. So any purely human vision of love, any way of conceiving of love that does not include the sacrifice of Jesus in leaving heaven and coming to earth and living and dying a terrible death for our sake, any vision of love that does not include that is really just a shadow of love. If human hearts are curved inward, then Jesus' heart was curved entirely outward. And that is love. And if we've experienced that love, John says, then we will be motivated to share it with others. And so that really is John's big idea in this particular passage, is the need for us to love each other. And he comes back to it and emphasizes it over and over again. I mean, just pounding home the point. How is God's love made complete in the world? How is his love made complete in the world? John says, when you love each other. How does the world see the connection between Jesus and those who follow him? How does that connection become obvious? John says, well, because you're like Jesus. You're actually like him in the way that you love each other. And then several times here he talks about how can we know that God lives in us? Because that God ultimately, by his Spirit, gives us of his Spirit because he wants to live in us. How can we know that God's Spirit is in us? And there's at least a couple answers in this passage. One is in verse 15. He says, if anyone acknowledges that Jesus is the Son of God, then God lives in him. So, you know, in a church like ours that emphasizes the importance of believing in Jesus, of trusting Jesus, and we can say amen to that. Yes, you'll know that God lives in you if you acknowledge Jesus, if you believe in Jesus. Ah, but John raises something else to the same level. He says, yes, if you acknowledge Jesus, if you believe in Jesus, then God lives in you. He also says in verse 12, if we love one another, then God lives in you. And he keeps ratcheting up the importance of loving each other. Verse 20, he says, whoever claims to love God, yet hates a brother or sister is a liar. Now, you may think to yourself, well, I don't hate anybody. Check. If you dive into the original Greek that the New Testament is written in, the word that we see as hate there can have a couple different meanings. One of the meanings is hate or detest. You know, so whoever claims to love God yet hates or detests a brother or sister is a liar. And we say, you know, my parents taught me not to hate. We're good. The other definition of the word that is hate in that verse is to love less. So let's reread it. Whoever claims to love God yet loves a brother or sister less is a liar. I don't like that version at all. So here's how I would summarize it. This is the big idea that I hope that you will take from this passage. When you wonder how it is between you and God, ask first how it is between you and others. If you're trying to, you know, measure, assess, you know, God, how are we? You know, how's our relationship? The first question you should ask is, how is it between me and others? See, it is easy for us when we're talking about a relationship with God to focus on it in a very abstract, spiritual, emotional way. You know, how do I feel about God? You know, I have affection for him. I feel kind of close to him. I had kind of like warm fuzzies when I read the Bible and prayed this morning. And so it's good between me and God. Can I suggest to you that we don't go by feelings? Because a better measure of how it is between us and God is how we are treating others. And so how is it? How is it between you and your spouse? How is it between you and your children? Or you and your parents? Or you and your coworkers? But don't stop there. How is it between you and that other person in your life? How is it between you and that person that feels like an enemy? How is it between you and the least of these, the last, the lost? How is it between you and that unemployed person? How is it between you and the victim of that tragedy? How is it between you and the immigrant? Between you and the citizen of the other nation that's at war with ours? How is it between you and that person who just seems to disagree with every opinion that you have? How is it between you and the person with that annoying habit or that awkward social manner? And how far will you go to practically love that person? How much are you willing to forgive or to overlook? How many chances are you willing to give to those who let you down? How gently do you let people down when you're disappointing them? Is there someone on the margins of your life that can't do much for you, can't advance your career, can't, you know, improve your home life, but someone that you could, should, need to love? And it might require slowing down. It might require paying attention, taking notice, giving up some control, putting up with some failures or flaws, with little obvious reward. That's the shift from me to you. Now, does that mean if our hearts are curved outward like that, does that mean that we never think about ourselves? I'd say no. I mean, you know, the person with the heart curved outward, the person who's loving like Jesus, is still very aware of who they are and their circumstances and their needs. It's just that those things don't drive them in every area of their lives. So, for example, decisions about my future are not so much about what should I do with my life, but where can I best serve others? A decision about giving financially is less about, you know, deciding, is this person or cause worthy of my money? And more about who needs my money more than I do? And would giving that money to them help them or hurt them? It's me to you. My prayers, when I've made the shift from me to you, are less about God help me and more about God they need your help. If you find yourself struggling to determine where you are on this me to you shift, here are some questions you might ask yourself. These aren't my questions. They're based on questions Steve Deneff asks in his book. And you don't necessarily have to jot these down. They're in the YouVersion app if you look there. Ask yourself, in a normal day, how much do you think of the opinions and needs of others? Or this one, what personal rights have you given up for the good of someone else? Or this one, what is something significant that you have done for someone other than yourself this week? Now, if you're really brave, go beyond these questions and talk to someone else who knows you well and ask them a question like this. Do you see me as more aware or more ignorant of the needs of others around me? Maybe a nicer way to ask that question is, you know, how in tune am I with the needs of others, would you say? Or how willing would you say I am to care for others? Now, we will begin to see progress in this shift from me to you when we find ourselves loving other people as automatically as you can tie your shoes or you can make the coffee or you can drive the car. I want to close with a story about the Salvation Army. This was years ago. It was time for their convention where, you know, Salvation Army members from all over the place would come together. And they were looking forward to having their founder, William Booth, speak at the convention. The problem was that at this, for this particular convention, he was sick and he wasn't able to travel. So he asked as an alternative if he could bring his speech to the people in writing, if he could, you know, write it down and have someone read it to the convention. And so that was the arrangement. And so, you know, the night of where his speech was going to be shared, people gathered. They were looking forward to, you know, to being inspired, to hearing a great explanation of the mission, to being reminded why they do what they do and you know, how they can do it better. And this speech that Booth prepared summarized their mission and their focus as a movement very well. Interestingly, the speech fit in one telegram. And in fact, the speech was one word: others. Would you pray with me? Father, I confess that I don't even realize always how self-centered I am. And I suppose that most of us could say the same. We don't even realize. Even when we think we're being focused on others, we can still be focused on ourselves. Oh God, open our eyes. Open our eyes. Jesus, you, in the moment of your life when you could have been entirely focused on yourself, when you hung on the cross, you prayed, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. Would you do a work inside of us, a work that we cannot do for ourselves, but we want to give you permission to do a work inside us that helps us to shift from being focused on myself to being focused on others? Would you help us to recognize our need and to step out in the ways that we care for others, that we might love as Jesus has loved us? It's in his name we pray these things. Amen.